Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My two guests today are prolific local writers. Later in the hour, novelist Emily Gallo tells us about her latest book, Roads Not Taken. My first guest will be at the Chico Museum at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, presenting the storybook Houses of Chico. Douglas Keister has a new book of architecture co-authored by Errol Gellner, a practicing architect and longtime syndicated columnist. Their book, Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s, is a coffee table book of fanciful architecture which features five homes in Chico. Douglas Keister, welcome.
Always good to be here.
Well, I'm so happy that you dedicated your book to me.
Yeah, I did. How nice of me.
Well, not just me, but to whom did you dedicate your book? I didn't mean to catch you off guard.
I dedicated it to everybody. No, well, I dedicated it to whimsy, people with whimsy. It's kind of a big blanket of dedication.
You said you dedicate this book to all those who embrace and incorporate whimsy into their lives.
Right. A whole lot of people. And well, the people I tend to like to hang around with.
Yeah, they're fun.
Yeah, they are.
Well, I was curious as to how you got the idea for a book like this.
Well, I used to live in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and one of my good friends was Errol Gellner, who had an architecture column and was a practicing architect. And we always said, we got to do a book together someday. We just didn't quite know.
Because you both have this interest in architecture.
Yes. Well, I had done a bunch of books on bungalows and what are called the Painted Ladies books on Victorians. And Errol is a great writer and also a great guy and a great friend. And we just said, we got to do something together. And we just didn't quite know what it was. But back then, I had a little bit of pull with, you know, in the New York publishing world. And Errol had written this article about some kind of whimsical architecture that was in Berkeley. And I said, you know, maybe I can convince my publisher that there should be a book about that. And we didn't even know what the history, the root of it was. But I convinced my publisher to do this book. And he actually said, well, you got to write an article first. You got to do something. So Errol wrote an article about it. And in the process of him researching and writing the article, for the newspaper, we were trying to ask people about, we were looking for a specific type of architecture. And we said, well, it's kind of like Hansel and Gretel stuff, kind of, you know, fairy tale, kind of. We couldn't think of a good name. And then one of us said, we're giving us joint, you know, authorship of this. We said jointly. We said, you know, like a storybook. And then we said, oh, that's it, storybook style. And really, we did not realize at the time that it really was a style of architecture that nobody had ever given a name to. And it only existed, you know, formally for about 10 years. And so in the process of doing the book, we wound up researching and figuring out where it all came from. And the original book came out in 2001, and it was the first time anybody had ever done a book on it. But, it had some gaps, and the publisher sold all the books and then decided, well, we're not going to do it anymore. And then a few years ago, I convinced a new publisher to redo the book with a lot more stuff, because we had a lot more information, too, about where it all came from. And it's a fascinating story that's never been told.
My guest is Douglas Keister, and we're talking about his latest architecture book, Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And I did jot down that you described it as Hansel and Gretel, and yeah. I did jot that down because, yeah, that's a way of describing it. Because we, as people are listening to you right now, can't see these beautiful color photographs. Yeah. And so we have to describe in words what the photographs are like in your book. So I think Hansel and Gretel can help.
You think about a Grimm's fairy tale, you know, a children's book or something like that. The houses with the swayback roofs, and that just they're just fanciful, you know, and they're very, very, very old, you know, European, very old European.
With the exception of Neuschwanstein.
That, well,
that Walt Disney said, ah, that looks like a real castle.
Right, right. Well, Walt Disney was an ambulance driver at the end of World War I. A lot of people don't know that. He actually showed up as the war ended, but he stayed in Europe for quite a while. You know, he still needed ambulances. And he saw or heard about a castle in Bavaria called Neuschwanstein. And he saw that. And later on, when he built Sleeping Beauty Castle, he modeled it on Neuschwanstein. But Neuschwanstein was built in the middle of the 19th century by this is Errol's language. It's wonderful. Intermittently lucid King Ludwig.
Oh, that's a complimentary way to say it, rather than
that's
yes.
A very, very good
and
description.
And saying crazy.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah, a kind way of saying crazy. But it was actually, when it was built in the middle of the 19th century, it was actually built to mimic an old style of architecture. So it wasn't like, although of course it was a new castle, but it was built to look old. So that is a hallmark of storybook style. It is houses that are built to look old.
So. You know, what you just said about Walt Disney driving an ambulance at the end of World War I that not many people know. In fact, you have a treasure trove of little facts that not many people know, and I'm sure it comes in handy because I didn't say so in your introduction, but you participate in trivia.
Yes, I do. I'm a sleuth. I mean, you know, I get something. I got to figure it out. And luckily, you know, my co-author, Errol, is the same way. We have to figure this out. Where did this come from? And storybook style, I think, is especially good for that because it's not a formal architecture style, you know, like Greek Revival or Art Deco or, you know, arts and crafts. It's this kind of weird style of architecture. So to figure that all out and you know, to kind of think about, well, this has got to happen and this has got to happen, and to have all those pieces of the puzzle just kind of fall into place. It was like, oh, we're right. it started right after World War I in Hollywood. And there was one particular man, Harry Oliver, who built this house for a movie set. And that was like the first storybook style house ever. And it was built for this movie called Face of the World. And it looks like something out of Germany or Bavaria or something like that. Very, very, very fairy tale-ish. And what's really, really interesting is that that house, which was moved just a few years later, still in the 1920s, to Beverly Hills, still exists today. And that's extremely unusual for the first of anything to still be around. And it doesn't quite fit into Beverly Hills really well, but there it is in Beverly Hills.
And you have a photograph of this house, which brings me to my question. Doug, I looked everywhere in your book for credit for the photographs. These photographs are spectacular, and I could not find any credit for the photographs.
Well, they're all mine.
I think you should give yourself credit.
Well, I'm on the cover of the book, you know.
Well, yes, and I did introduce you as a photographer,
right.
But I think you ought to say the photographs in this book are by Douglas Keister.
Yeah. Well, there are some archival photographs.
That's what I assume, too.
Yes, yeah. And we, of course, put credits there. Was one of the big differences from the original book to the new book. I stumbled on, actually, a guy named Mark Wanamaker in Los Angeles, who's like the king of historic Los Angeles photographs, and he generously let us use a whole bunch of them, like the construction of that house I'm talking about, which, by the way, is called the Witch's House, sometimes called the Spadina House, too.
Well, with all the beautiful photographs to choose from, I wondered how you happened to choose the one that you did for your cover, because it is beautiful, but there are a lot of beautiful ones. And I have my own ideas about why this one was chosen, but I'd like to hear your reasons.
Well, there are some very practical reasons, which kind of take a little bit of the gusto out of it. But it runs really well vertically for the cover. So, and it's, you know, it's got a fair amount of sky, but also it is...
So a nice blue sky in the background.
It's got a nice blue sky, but it's got a wave roof, which is this, you know...
Very characteristic of these types of houses.
And it's got a turret. And also one of the hallmarks of storybook style is that these houses don't have porches, like we consider porches. A little tiny, tiny porch. I mean, just maybe a little thing over it, and it has that. And it is located, although we say it in the captions in the book, it's located probably about 10 or 12 blocks from the original Disney studio in the Los Feliz area of Los Angeles. So it's kind of got it all. It's got, and it's a stucco, which is what storybooks should be. And it's whimsical. There are very few straight lines, because storybook style, if you start putting straight lines, it doesn't look old. I mean, as anybody that's old knows, gravity, you know, takes hold, and that's one of the hallmarks of it, is artificial aging and the effects of gravity. And so that's what this house is. And it's little, little tiny house.
Well, and I'll tell you then a couple of things that I thought maybe went into the choice of it. It is a little house, but you also make the point that architects often create almost an optical illusion to make the house look bigger by the scale. But it has the turret. You mentioned the roof, and that is very characteristic of this style. The houses in development, at least one of them has to have a turret. But also, I thought another reason you may have chosen it is that a lot of these houses are on a small lot.
Right.
And this house is located far enough back that you've got this lovely kind of stone walkway leading up to
kind
it.
Kind of a serpentine,
nice. So I thought maybe that was one reason.
Yes, that's right. It's kind of got it all. And that, if you have any, like if you had a regular straight sidewalk, it wouldn't be right. You know, you want it to curve, and you want voids in the sidewalk where the grass is growing up. So it just looks old. And they're adorable, these houses. If these houses don't make you smile when you see them, there's something wrong with you.
My guest is author and photographer Douglas Keister. His newest architecture book is Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And I mentioned this beautiful house on the front cover. And then I turn over on the back of your book, and here it says, Homes of the Moment in Eastwood Park, Chico, California.
Yeah, it's great.
And on this flyer, I guess it is, the phone number has two digits, 98. So that gives us a clue right there that it's quite old. And I didn't recognize the house on the cover, I don't think.
No, because it was never built.
Aha. Uh-huh.
A number of houses in the flyer have been built, and also they still exist in Chico. And that's another great thing about Chico, the houses in Chico, it's one of the largest intact storybook style enclaves in America. And I know these things because I've been everywhere. And it was built, this tract was built in the late 1920s, which fits right into our 10-year time period by a guy named Orville Tracy.
I thought that was curious. His name, his first name is Orville.
Yeah, it's Orville, but it's close enough. O.E. Tracy. And his son, Bud Tracy, is still a realtor in Oroville. And it was this little tract called Eastwood Park, kind of centered, you might say, around 9th and Cypress, and you know, a few blocks around there, over 100 homes with various degrees of storybook elements. And it was built to appeal to a little bit, not really upper crust, but the doctors and the university professors, because these little houses cost more, even though they look very diminutive. They cost more because of all those curves and all that, the special effects, the artificial aging. So they cost more. And then, of course, when the Depression hit, it all stopped because nobody had any money anymore.
Well, years ago, when I moved to Chico, and you can't help but notice these houses. They are so eye-catching.
Yeah.
And as you ride down the street and you see these houses, you think, what's the story behind these houses?
I thank the Chico Historical Society, John Gallardo, a guy named Alan Tokerman, who had this original brochure that is on the back of the book really contribute to this, to contribute to the story. I also like to point out, anybody that lives in Chico, it's gone up 9th Street on the way to the freeway, notices this one house with a wave roof. Mm-hmm. A wave shingle roof. It's not in the book. And people go, why isn't that in the book? Well, I said, because the lines of it are straight and it's not right. And so, and I'm
So it didn't make the cut.
It did not make the cut. I'm the arbiter of of storybook style. And it, somebody at some point has looks like they put in, you know, vinyl siding or something like that on it. But it can be saved.
My guest is Douglas Keister. His newest architecture book is The Storybook Style and the America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And you have kind of taken a theatrical motif, if I want to call it that, in naming your chapters. You have chapters, The Opening Act, Now Playing Nationwide, Ensembles, Encores.
Right.
So these are some of your chapter names that you carry out this theatrical motif.
Yeah, it just fits so well into it because when they were started, the reason these homes got started in Los Angeles because the period film was all the rage. And so the boys, when they came home from World War I, they had these, they remember what they saw, especially in France. And when they were hired as set designers, they, kind of took that knowledge and things that they'd seen. And then when they started moonlighting as builders, they applied those things they'd seen in Europe to this style of architecture, including Hollywoodland.
Yes, and one of your chapters is called Hollywoodland.
Right.
And people say, Hollywoodland?
Right.
What's that about?
Yeah, that was this developer in the mid-1920s, really, that there was this tract of land, and there were two men, and they developed it, and they built this big sign. And it said Hollywood Land on it. And it was originally intended to be what they called at the time Romantic Revival Homes. And there was just brochures about it. And a number of them were built. Matter of fact, in the book, I have Humphrey Bogart's old house and Gloria Swanson's house. And the Humphrey Bogart's old house, when I photographed it, was owned by Dean of Jan and Dean. Efren Symbolist Senior's house, which when I photographed it had just been sold by a guy named Moby, a musician. But people don't realize that sign originally said Hollywood Land, and it was all supposed to be that kind of style. But of course, once again, by 1930 or 1929, when the Depression happened, the money ran out, and just all sorts of houses got built there rather than just storybook.
Well, you have a photograph when the sign did say Hollywood Land, and there are some dignitaries in this black and white photograph.
Right.
They're all dressed in their suits and their hats, and they have some mules.
Yeah, pulling the plow.
Pulling a plow up on this hill with this Hollywood Land developer. And you couldn't take this picture today because the land came off the Hollywoodland sign.
Right.
And what was the story of that? Why did they do that?
The sign in general deteriorated, and they were going to tear it all down. And then the Chamber of Commerce basically said, well, let's figure out a way to save this. We'll take the land part off. So it was just, less maintenance because it was just easier to do it that way. And, and even as soon, I think 25, 30 years ago, it really got deteriorated, but then people adopted letters and sponsored letters to keep it going. And of course, now it's a worldwide
It's a landmark.
It's a landmark. and but people don't know it was an advertisement for what are now called storybook style homes.
So he was going to develop this. So Hollywood Land was established in 1923.
Right.
So that again fits into this time slot that you have designated. And I think we've pretty much covered what you call your chapter one is the backstory.
Right.
And is there anything else you want to add? Because there you have a photograph of this rather exotic-looking Oriental Eastern...
Right, Brighton Pavilion. One of the things about storybook style, it took its cues, you might say, to this whole thing of back in the 19th century, there was this rapid industrialization, and people were looking to recapture, you know, part of the handmade things and things that were more natural looking. The whole arts and crafts movement developed from that. And even Marie Antoinette, you know, she, you know, we don't think of her, we think of her as a very formal sort of person, but she wanted to, you know, hearken back to her childhood. So she had her architect build a little village in a corner of Versailles, and it's still there today. And I got permission to photograph that inside and out when I was in Versailles. So the storybook style is this whole thing of kind of getting back to more natural ways of seeing things, the picturesque landscape movement. There are some people now and then that do build storybook style homes. They're very expensive to build because the craftspeople that can do that kind of thing just don't exist anymore. So they kind of have to reinvent all of these techniques. But there is a chapter called Encores in the book where I feature some more modern interpretations of storybook style. I mean, in Carmel and Louisville, Kentucky, in Texas, they are here and there. The best one is in a place called Olalla, Washington, appropriately enough.
I noticed that name in your book.
We also have in the book, I think in the first chapter, you know, we kind of have the whole story of how it all evolved. And also, you know, it's a little bit of a distraction, but you know, from the first book in 2001 that came out till now, now that storybook style, people know what it is. I was contacted by many, many people. And so I took new pictures of houses, and people finally realized what they have. Before, they didn't even know what they had. So there's been this really kind of a renaissance, you might say, of storybook style houses. And hopefully in a place like here in Chico, people will really appreciate what they have, what we have here, what a resource we have. I mean, there is really, I say it's one of the most intact enclaves in the country, but I would say it is the most intact enclave in the entire country. And it's amazing it's in Chico rather than Los Angeles. So we have a real resource here that hopefully people will embrace.
My guest is Douglas Keister. He is a writer and photographer, and his latest book is Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. He is co-author of this book. And when I think of this style of architecture, I think of Gaudí.
Yes.
And his very natural, organic kind of architecture. And it's such a contrast to this picture you have in your book of arabesque, even.
Right, but that's all part of that. It's all this it's whimsy. You look at that picture, of course, we can't see on the radio. It's whimsy. It makes you smile. And as a matter of fact, of course, in the book, we have photographs I took in Barcelona of Gaudí's architecture. So it's all part of the story. And the last picture in the introduction, I have Art Deco architecture just to show you what happened. And it is very angular, very upright. And then you can really see the contrast between storybook and, you know, streamline architecture and Art Deco architecture, kind of what happened. So if you read the book and you look at the captions and look at the houses, you'll be able to pick out storybook style architecture or places that are what I call a nod to storybook style. They may not be full on, but they have elements of it. And we have some wonderful ones here in Chico.
Well, if people do want to see these Chico houses, you've kind of mentioned where they are located. Could you describe, because there's one that's kind of obvious. It has the characteristic turret. It also has these little slits of windows that I always look at when I'm in Europe and I see castles. They have these little very narrow windows. And people might think, oh, that's just some kind of architectural feature there. But it really, in the original castles and fortresses, they served a purpose. So describe what that Chico house with the turret has.
That's on Eastwood Street. And there are two of them, one on either end of the street. And they're mirror images of each other. If you look really close, they were one is brick and one is stucco. And sometimes some of these things are dovecotes where they would have doves, raise them for eating, and others so archers, you know, could defend the castle. So they have this very narrow slit, and they can just narrow enough to put their bow and to see through there.
But the enemy could not hit that tiny little
very
slot. It would be very hard to do, whereas the person inside protecting himself could aim his bow.
And most people, when they see the house on Eastwood Street, the one that's kind of pinkish, kind of peachy colored, not peachy colored, it looks like it's just one house. It was actually a duplex.
That surprised me, too. And then I looked more closely, and I could see, oh, it does have another door over there on the side.
Yeah. No, actually, there's a door. There are two doors in the turret. You can't even see them.
You know what else I appreciate about these houses? My house was built much later than this, and it has the biggest feature in the front of my house is the garage.
Right.
It's very practical, and I'm glad I have that garage, but these houses look so much better. And how did they pull that off?
There's an alley, and one of the things you see in Chico a lot are alleys. And so in Eastwood Park, there are alleys, and so that's where the garages are. So the streetscape has great curb appeal because there's... And you don't see a lot of cars on the street because they're in the back. So the streetscape is just beautiful without all those nasty-looking garages.
It's true. Well, what about some of the other houses? You have a picture of a house, a brick with a turret.
Right, and that's the mirror image of the other one. You don't really recognize it immediately.
Because they look so different.
Right.
Different material.
But you look, if you compare it to the other one, they're exact mirror images. And that one still is a duplex. The other one has been converted into a single family home. There are a lot of houses on 8th Street, and a lot of those have cat slide roofs, and that is that roof that kind of curves around. And other features that you'll see in some of the Chico houses are rolled eaves, where the shingles roll around, and that is to mimic thatch. And very expensive to build that, but that's it's an artificial it's a little feature to it just makes it more fun, but it's more expensive to build, obviously. So the artificial aging with the cat slide roofs, the tiny little porches, Errol, I'd say that you'll kind of know one when you see it because it's whimsical. It has that you can't define whimsy, but you know it when you see it.
Well, I think people now who live in Chico or live outside Chico, it's worth a trip, I think, to just ride down these neighborhoods in Chico that you have described and pick out these whimsical homes.
Right. People love them. People absolutely love them.
Well, Doug, you have written another book. So this book, again, I'll remind people the name of this book we've just been talking about, Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And he wrote that with a co-author. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Emily Gallo will read from her latest novel, Roads Not Taken. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Emily Gallo was born in New York City and lived in San Francisco and Los Angeles before moving to Chico when she married economics professor David Gallo. She has a BA in English from Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, and taught elementary school students in low-income, ethnically diverse neighborhoods before retiring and starting a writing career. With three other women, Emily Gallo founded a writing group at the Jesus Center in Chico. She got the idea from a screenplay she wrote called The Road Not Taken, about a protagonist who founded a writing group for the homeless in New York's Central Park. The Chico group published two literary magazines called The Derelict Voice. We'll be hearing from these authors later in the show. Emily Gallo's first novel, Venice Beach, started out as a TV show. She wrote a pilot and a few episodes before deciding to turn it into a novel. She has now completed a sequel to Venice Beach, The Columbarium. Tomorrow she will be launching her new book at a fundraiser for the Museum of Northern California Art, whose home will be the Veterans Memorial Hall in Chico. Emily Gallo, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you decided to turn your book that was a screenplay into a novel. Why did you change from a screenplay to a novel?
Well, first of all, the whole Hollywood has gone crazy. It's it's very difficult now to get screenplays on. I had a actually had written The Columbarium as a screenplay, and I had a producer. I had everything on track. We had investors from Europe, and it was all going very well. And then, in typical Hollywood fashion, it fell apart. So I said, you know, I think I'd rather write a novel where I have a little more control. And so that's what I've done. I've switched to being a novelist at this point.
Well, then the title of your book, I think, is a mystery in itself. The Columbarium? What is that?
I have met one person who knows what a columbarium is, and they are all over the place. I've been to them in other cities. They're not unique. But I'd like to tell the little story about how I found the columbarium in San Francisco.
Well, yeah, I do want to know how you became interested in the San Francisco Columbarium, but I think maybe it might be that it relates to a subject that we don't want to think about.
Well, the thing about the Columbarium in San Francisco is that it's a rather pleasant place to be. It's a beautiful building, and, well, I guess we need to tell people what a columbarium is.
Well, yes, do that.
Let's start there. A columbarium is a building that has niches. And it's where people put their ashes in urns or some other...
After being cremated.
So instead of a mausoleum or a cemetery, people can use a columbarium for the ashes, or instead of strewing the ashes in the ocean or wherever. And that's what a columbarium is, and they are everywhere. This particular columbarium that I wrote about is in San Francisco.
And how did you become interested in writing a novel about something that sounds depressing?
Well, that's what was such an interesting story. I have a friend who lives in San Francisco, and I was living in Davis at the time. He was visiting me. This is probably 7 years ago or so. And he said, you know, where can I get a Chinese food takeout cart in one of those cardboard cartons? I said, I don't know. I guess at a Chinese restaurant, but why would you need that? He said, well, I have a friend who's dying, and she wants to put her ashes in it, to put in the columbarium. And I said, huh? And that was how one of the characters in the book, I will say,
so
has her
this.
Ashes. I used that. That was the spark. And I didn't know what a columbarium was either. And the story he told was exactly the story that is in the book with Tony trying to find one of those takeout cartons that he could use to put his friend's ashes in.
Yeah, so even though this is a novel, I knew that a lot of it was true. I mean, this columbarium really exists in San Francisco,
yes,
so I know that
does.
Was true. And then you were just saying that the incident with the guy looking for a Chinese carryout carton for his friend's ashes was true.
And then I went to visit the columbarium in San Francisco.
Where in San Francisco is this?
It's at One Lorraine Court, which is up in the Richmond area, north of Golden Gate Park.
Because Colma is famous for its cemetery, and so you might expect it to be there.
Well, yeah, and there's actually another columbarium in Oakland. There's a couple in New York, and I've been to one of them in New York, which is from Revolutionary times, and actually Leonard Bernstein was buried in the one in New York. And the one in San Francisco has some famous people, Mr. Haight, Mr. Ashbery, both buried there or in niches there.
My guest is Emily Gallo, and she is telling us about her latest novel, which is a sequel to her earlier book, Venice Beach. This one is The Columbarium, which is a real architectural feature, a real building, and she has visited the one in San Francisco.
And what's So I went to visit it, and there is really a caretaker there whose name is Emmett Watson, and I spoke with him, and he is actually nothing to do with
So you have a character. You have a character in your book that's a caretaker
exactly.
for the Columbarium in your book. And this also is based on a real person. You certainly didn't use his name.
Exactly.
His real name was
Emmett Watson. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, as I said, it has nothing to do with Jed, but it was just the spark I needed, you know, visiting this incredible building. It's gorgeous. Looking at the niches, talking to Emmett, and then I just decided to take pictures of some of the niches. I didn't want to know the people that were buried in them. It just started the whole creative process of, oh, this would be a great, well, at the time, screenplay. And I took pictures and just made up characters that would have to do with the niches that I took pictures of. And that's how it all started.
So that you could tell the story of these characters and their relationship to the Columbarium.
Right.
So when you were selecting characters, you had some characters already in mind. Oh, well, these characters could be doing these things, having these experiences. But you start, though, so the character, the main character in this book has a very interesting background. And you start your book with, in the prologue, telling us, you don't say who is speaking. This is told in the first person, but we don't know who this person I is. What is that prologue?
The prologue, why don't I read a little
okay.
of it to just give an idea. White knight, everyone to the pavilion right away. Your lives are in danger. Was this the real thing or another one of his cruel jokes, the ones he called rehearsals? We'd been on our best behavior for the congressman and his entourage last night. We sang and danced and told him how much we loved being here and how wonderful Father was. I asked my mother why she believed all this crap. She looked at me with vacant, fearful eyes, but didn't answer. She just held my baby sister tight to her chest. When his voice came over the loudspeaker, we knew we had to go. She took my hand, and we walked to the pavilion.
Now, Emily, when I read that, at first I didn't know White Knight, everyone at the pavilion, but then you mentioned his cruel jokes, his rehearsals, but then you said we'd been on our best behavior for the congressman and his entourage last night. Then I knew where this was taking place. And these were the actual words of Jim Jones, as I remember them. You actually used his dialogue.
Exactly.
And
they took us and put us in chains. They robbed us of our land. We tried to find a new beginning, but it's too late. Don't lay down with tears and agony. We must die with some dignity. Mother, 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 please. Mother, please, 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 don't do this. Lay down your life with your child, but don't do this.
Yeah, I remember hearing those words of James Jones when he was asking people to commit suicide, to drink the Kool-Aid. And since then, we've had that expression. I don't know if people now remember where that came from.
As I ask around, it's kind of like the Columbarium.
People don't know.
Or, you know, people under the age of 40 or 50, I guess I should say, because this was all in the late 70s.
Yeah. In Emily Gallo's fifth novel, Murder at the Columbarium, she revisits the title location in her second novel. Now, I mentioned that you have three previous novels, but they really are related. And in what way are your, and this is your fourth, are your four novels related?
Well, I start with Venice Beach and the characters that were in Venice Beach. And I take these characters into my next novels. They're not exactly sequels, although there's a chronological order to it. And you don't have to have read the first one to read the second. But they're like family, and they keep reappearing in my next books.
So you have Venice Beach, and remind us the other one, because the second one, you, even in the very title, I think you introduce an unfamiliar term, Columbarium.
Columbarium, and I have to tell you that 99% of the people I know do not know what a Columbarium is. A Columbarium, this one takes place in San Francisco at the Columbarium there, but they're all over the world. In fact, you talk about Doug Keister, and we've gotten to know each other because he writes about cemeteries, and we can relate together. Anyway, the Columbarium is a place where people put their ashes in niches. And the one in San Francisco is a gorgeous, gorgeous building. It's very special. And Jed, who is the character from Venice Beach, one of the main characters, when Venice Beach is over, He leaves Los Angeles on a bus. Well, we don't know that he's on a bus until the beginning of the Columbarium, and then it's his story in San Francisco at the Columbarium.
So you teach us, you were a teacher, you teach us new concepts like this very concept of a columbarium that you say 90% of the people you talk to have never heard that term.
That's right.
And yet when you learn what it is, you think, well, yeah, that makes sense.
And you may have even seen one and not known
and
really not what the word was. Yeah,
that term. And then your last book was Kate and Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
And that also takes place in?
Northern California, a smaller town, but a lot of San Francisco in it as well. And Kate is the daughter of Finn, who is the protagonist of Venice Beach, and she's in Venice Beach quite a bit also.
So your novels are a combination of your own creativity and imagination, and yet there's enough fact there that we feel like we're learning new things from you. And I'll have to tell you, this fourth novel of yours, Emily, I was amazed at what I did not know. And I'll tell you that when I was reading the back cover of your book, I read that first paragraph several times saying, what does she mean by that? It's your book, this newest novel, Roads Not Taken, is described as a coming-of-age story with a twist. When Malcolm thinks he has found the woman of his dreams, and Malcolm is the protagonist in your new novel, he's forced into reevaluating his beliefs and conceptions while exploring the meaning of love that knows no gender. And I couldn't quite get my mind around that. So already, before I even started reading this novel, I think, what does she mean by that?
I worked very hard on that. You know, for me, writing a 350-page book is a lot easier than writing two sentences of what it's about.
I'm sure. You have to be so selective.
But I kind of wanted that to be something that kind of just piqued people's interest. Is like, what is she talking about? And of course, we can now say that it's about transgender, non-binary.
Well, we don't know that before we start reading
know.
Your book, because it's not exactly that either. It's something that I wasn't even familiar with the concept. Also on the back cover of your book, you'll love the personalities and stay for the mystery as Emily Gallo uses her great characters to tell an interesting story that weaves the past and the present together beautifully. So your characters are not, their lives are not lives of ease. The back cover also says, through the less than fortunate life circumstances of some of her characters, the author is able to give an inside look at how current social policies impact real-world situations, offering a greater perspective that is often overlooked. And so that also piques our curiosity as to how can that be? So who are, I mentioned that this person named Malcolm is the protagonist in your newest novel. And before we, I want to ask you to read a section from your book, but who is Malcolm?
Well, Malcolm was, if you remember from Venice Beach, a 14-year-old homeless kid on the boardwalk of Venice Beach, and Roads Not Taken is about 15 years later, and he's back in Venice Beach. He's had gone into the Army and taken some classes and been around, but he's back in Venice Beach, and it's his story, and it includes a person he never even really knew 15 years ago, but she was also in the first book, Venice Beach.
My guest is Emily Gallo. She's a novelist, and you have also written, besides the novels you've written, I think you've written some for television?
I have written screenplays. In fact, really, that's my honest hope is that I would like to see my books on the screen.
In fact, I could see this as a TV series because you have recurring characters, and
exactly.
I could see this as a TV series.
That's exactly hoping to do.
Keep our fingers crossed, Emily.
Yeah.
So Malcolm, then, is your protagonist, and I would like you to read from Chapter 8 in your book, Emily. And Malcolm is asking somebody, what's your story? And who is that he's asking? Before we read that, though, let's look at Chapter 8. This is when you might set this up, and the character in this chapter is Violet. And I'm particularly curious.
I was waiting for you to mention that one.
to get to know what you said about Violet, because I love this sentence, that not everyone was as spry or energetic as Violet. And when I read that, I could just see this real person who lives here in Chico who teaches line dancing.
Well, you might remember, Nancy, you and I actually went line dancing together and met this woman, and she really was. That's how I write. I meet someone. I don't take their whole character of who they are, but it's that little something inside them and something about them that becomes a character in my book. And yes, I don't even remember what her name was. Do you?
Pat. It was Pat.
Okay.
Because you and I were talking after we talked about your last book, and you said you're in the process of researching your fourth novel, and you're going to have your character go line dancing, but you mm-hmm. weren't familiar with line dancing. You said you were going to go check out the local scene of line dancing, and would I like to go with you? I thought, sure, I'm up for that. And when we went, there was this older lady who was so full of energy and so enthusiastic about line dancing. Then when I read Violet, I thought, yeah, there's a real person like that, just like that. So right. I enjoyed this part of your book. So what happens then?
Well, Malcolm gets a job working in a senior residence, and Violet is one of the people who lives there, and Violet is teaching line dancing to the people at the residence.
Well, you young people, this is a quote, oh, you young people just dance wildly like your knickers are in a knot and you have to, anyway, she says, follow me.
Okay.
And she proceeded to show Malcolm some line dance steps.
And he followed along. Do you want to take the Violet? Nancy and I like to play this little game.
Well, bless your pea-picking heart. That's the ticket.
Malcolm not only learned quickly, but also enjoyed himself immensely. He peeked at George to see if he had any interest, but George's eyes never left the TV screen. A couple of others in the room watched, however, and Malcolm danced over to them to see if they were interested in learning. They waved him off, but Malcolm's wheels were turning. This might be something. Have some of these older people teach what they know how to do. After Homer finished bemoaning his move to the land of California from his sweet home in Chicago, Malcolm thanked Violet for the lesson and went to the reception desk to get some paper and pencil. He wanted to make more lists about the folks who peopled the halls of this residence. He would find out what talents they had, where they were from, and made some notations on personality types and frailties. Not everyone was as spry or energetic as Violet.
Novelist Emily Gallo is reading from her fourth novel, Roads Not Taken. And so we meet this character, Violet, who just, I can just so visualize, imagine this woman, because we met a woman like that. Now, later on in your book, you mentioned a character that comes up in this novel that was also in your Venice Beach novel. And who is this person?
This is Savali. And in the Venice Beach novel, she's a kind of minor character, but she works out at Muscle Beach, which is in Venice, a place on the boardwalk where people work out. And you're not quite sure if it's a female or a male working out. And she becomes a major character in Roads Not Taken.
So Malcolm, like the rest of us, don't really understand who she is. And so I'd like you to, if you would start reading there where Malcolm says, I don't really understand what you are.
And what's your story? Malcolm might finally get some answers to all his questions about her, if she was truly a she. The waiter set the beers down on the table, and Savali took a long swig from hers. Malcolm wasn't sure if that was to waste time or if it was just for emphasis. He waited for her to answer, which took a few minutes. You really want to know, don't you? Malcolm nodded and took another swig. You want to know if I'm a male or female? Malcolm nodded and waited for an answer. When none was forthcoming after a couple of minutes passed, he answered, If you want to talk about it, you don't have to. Of course I don't have to. I'm sorry, it's none of my business. Forget it. Savali took another large sip. Neither. Malcolm stared at her. Neither what? Neither male or female. Or both. Depends how you want to look at it. Have you ever heard of a fa-fa-fine? No. What's that? Again, Savali took a sip and stayed quiet. The waiter brought their food. Two more? Malcolm looked at Savali, but she didn't respond. Not right now, he answered. They ate silently for several minutes. Malcolm decided he should wait for Savali to share whatever she wished to. If it were nothing, then it would be an awkward lunch. But she finally spoke after eating half her meal. Third gender is a classification in lots of cultures. Fa-fa-fine is the name for Samoans who don't identify male or female specifically.
So there we learn that this term that she presents to Malcolm is from the Samoan language, and you say her name is Samoan.
Correct.
So that's kind of a hard concept to take in for Samoans who don't identify male or female specifically, if you'd continue there.
Malcolm thought about that for a minute. He still didn't feel like his question was answered. Okay, but that's not me exactly. I see. He wasn't sure how to respond. He waited to see if more information was imminent. Third gender is not transgender, transsexual, or intersexual. It's different. So that's how you label yourself? Third gender? Some cultures recognize five or more genders. Native Americans use a term called two-spirit. There are lots of variations. I don't like to label myself at all. So what pronoun do you use? I use I and me. Okay. What pronoun would you like others to use to refer to you? She smiled. You? Come on, Savali, you know what I mean. He or she. A lot of folks like they. Is that what you want to use? What do you want to use? Malcolm sighed. You can be so aggravating sometimes. I know. It's what makes me so lovable. She patted his arm. I don't care, honestly. Just do what makes you comfortable. I'm comfortable with any and all of them. Well, I'd prefer to use she. Then use it for now. I'll let you know if I change my mind. She laughed.
Novelist Emily Gallo is reading from her fourth novel, Roads Not Taken. And this, when I read this section, it sent me to Wikipedia, and I read up on this idea of, pronounce this word again, Emily.
Fa-fa-fine.
And it's spelled F-A-apostrophe-A-F-A-F-I-N-E, if
Correct.
Anybody else wants to Google this term, because your description of it in her words is what is found on the internet. And it's such an unusual concept, but I was surprised. I'd never encountered this term before.
What really surprised me was I read up on all these other cultures and how many other cultures have more than two, more than three genders. It was fascinating. The Jewish culture, the Native American culture.
Yeah, you mentioned the Native Americans.
Yeah.
And yet we are only now in our culture beginning to wonder, well, when you fill out a form, we've only got two choices, male and female. We're starting to change.
A law was actually passed in California that there's a third place for non-binary.
So, and I know you started this novel some time ago, but you're very timely.
Exactly.
with your subject. And you, I've already started on your fourth novel. And at the end of the last novel, you gave us a little preview of this one. And at the end of this novel, we get an excerpt from your next novel. And what's the title of your next novel?
Murder at the Columbarium. So I'm trying a murder mystery here. We'll see how it goes. But that is Jed and Malcolm are actually the
continuing in there. Well, people might wonder, well, why is Malcolm so curious about Savali? And maybe they might guess he feels an attraction to her, and yet he can't quite figure out what to make of it. And she says she's on a spectrum, a gender spectrum. And she says there are a lot of different gender identities on the spectrum. And so Malcolm obviously wants to know where she is on that spectrum. And so would you pick up and read in your chapter where Savali says, well, that's a fair question. This is on page 252 in your book. And he says he's not interested in a definition. He wants to know.
I don't really understand what you are. I consider myself non-binary, not male or female. There are a lot of different gender identities on the spectrum, you know. I'm not interested in Wikipedia's definition. I want to know where you are on that spectrum. Fair enough. I was born a male in Samoa. I was called Fafafine, which is considered a third gender there. My family treated me like a girl, and I fulfilled the role of daughter. When I moved to the United States, I found out that wasn't acceptable as it is in Samoa. I had to make some decisions on what gender I wanted to embrace. I went to some support groups, a couple of doctors and therapists, and experimented with dating both men and women. I realized that I was, in fact, comfortable in my body and my mind in both genders. I also realized that I could wake up on any given day and prefer to dress or behave in one or the other. In other words, I identify as both, and I identify as neither. Does that make sense? Sort of. Well, I also realized that I was happy and not the least bit conflicted over it, even though all those doctors and therapists tried to convince me that I was a psychological mess. She took Malcolm's hand and looked deeply into his eyes. I understand that this might be hard for you to believe, but really, I am very happy and at peace with who I am. I do believe you. I also understand that this is a lot for you to take in. You haven't spent a lifetime exploring your sexual identity. You can't welcome me as a lover without doing the mental work first. Thanks for understanding that. I can wait, but we cannot deny the attraction and strong feelings we have for each other.
This is novelist Emily Gallo reading from her fourth novel, Roads Not Taken. And we don't want to spoil the suspense here by giving away any more of the story. We will look forward to your next novel, where we will see some of these characters again, and the title of your next novel, Murder at the Columbarium. Thank you, Emily Gallo.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Douglas Keister, photographer and co-author of Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And Douglas Keister will be lecturing at the Chico Museum on Salem Street in Chico tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I'd also like to thank local author Emily Gallo, whose fourth novel is Roads Not Taken. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.